Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
One. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we get to talk to Matt Finch, who's an Emmy Award-winning designer for Swords and Wizardry. He also created Osric and the Quick Primer for Old School Gaming. And today, we get to talk to him about his newest opus, the Tome of World Building. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into the discussion with Matt, I'll just remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server that's available to all our patrons, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. And then about 10 minutes after the hour, around like 2:10 Eastern time, we'll be there live to host a video chat, so we hope you can join us.
We love that every week, and maybe this week, maybe we could even entice our guest to join in. I'm not, no promises, but maybe we can get our guest, namely the illustrious Matt Finch. And Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem at all. I'm pleased to be here, and I will be in Discord, assuming that I can navigate the technological difficulties of getting there. But after a couple of times, I think I've got it. I ought to be there this time.
We've done it before. I believe this will be the third. You'll level up to level 3, I believe, this time. So yeah, I think we can make that happen. So Matt, you have an already very successful Kickstarter that's up, and we are getting to talk to you in the last 48 hours or so. Yeah. Currently on Kickstarter from your Mythmir Games. Actually, not just one, but actually two books. So you've got the Tome of World Building. And you also have the Nomicon for naming things in your fantasy world, and we got to get a little bit of a sneak peek of both of those, and boy, they're right up the Wandering DM's alley. So we occasionally do live dungeon design dashes on air here, and every time we do that, we are using your Tome of Adventure Design. And so it's among your products are among our favorite ones, and your Tome of World Building seems to be hitting us at a really good time. So yeah. tell us about your Tome of World Building.
Well, the original idea was that I was just going to do a Tome of World Building. And, I realized that, there are a couple of things that are really important to world building. You know, one of them is the mapping, and let's put that aside because it's different than the other issues. But most of what makes up a fantasy world is not really the reality or the consistency of it. It is the name. It's two things. It's the names and it's the little stories, you know, that if you turn to a kingdom, this kingdom is at war with another kingdom because of X. And so it's just those little bits and pieces of stories, little bits and pieces of mythology. So the majority of the book is generating that sort of depth for the thing. It's the stories and the names. And I very quickly realized that if I was going to include names in there, it was going to be an enormous book, and there would be a lot of page flipping because the names have, subtable after subtable, and the things in the Tome of World Building have subtable after subtable, and that it was going to work a lot better, especially for physical use, if you could have two books open at the same time. Especially since a lot of the Tome, since a lot of the Nomicon is divided into fake naming groups, some of them based on real world phonemes being put together, and some of them being entirely imaginary, like dark metallic, high metallic, elder weirdish, colossoponderous, dreamlandish. There are a lot of these sort of naming groups to keep your country consistent. And when you have that, that means you can leave the book, open to that area while you're generating stuff using the Tome of World Building. So that's the reason why it ended up being bifurcated into two books instead of one. But the original idea was that names were going to be just in the tables along with this stuff.
Got it. I can see they're cross-referenced, but the two books cross-reference each other.
They are. I mean, nobody, you know, you guys have seen a draft of it. Nobody else has really seen much of a draft, but there are a lot of places where you get to the name of a thing in the Tome of Worldbuilding, and then it'll say, here are some places you may want to look in the Nomicon for what the name of this might be. So, for example, powerful spellcasters, there are a couple of naming groups that tend to generate names that sound like powerful spellcasters. There's the Arabish naming group. There's one of the Dreamlandish naming groups works particularly well for powerful spellcasters. And so there's that sort of back and forth through the books all the way through.
Very nice. Very nice. Let's talk about, and I want to talk about the naming philosophy separately, but let's talk about the overall process that you lay out in the Tome of World Building. And so the first thing I take away is it's a top-down process. So yes. You have chapters on, broadly, you're not saying people should spend forever on this, but broadly sketching out the idea for your cosmos, and then what's the world like, and then what's the continents like, and then what's the home continent of the players like, and the cultures and the countries and so forth. Is that the model you have in your head, or did I miss any particular important part there?
No, that's absolutely the model for the way that the book is organized. It's the reverse of the way that I and most people do it, which is starting small. But I think the way that it's going to happen is that people will go ahead and start small, and then you hit the point where your players want to start traveling, and you're like, okay, now I need to have, and then you know, you sort of start at the beginning. The starting with the cosmos was more, that's not really part of the top-down thing. That was, there are a few things that you're going to want to define really before you start playing. And those are things like, are law, chaos, good? Are those cosmic forces with their own intelligence that do a thing? Or are they cosmic forces that are relatively unintelligent? And getting that kind of stuff, mainly having to do with alignment. Getting that nailed down early on is probably a good idea for anybody, even if you are going to start small. These are the kind of things that you think about. What makes my, what are we going to do that's interesting in this campaign? It's sort of that phase of thought. But then after that, yes, it's definitely top down, and it's just, it tries to have the right level of detail to get you focused where you need to be. So, you do some work on the other continents first. But that's specifically because those other continents, all that you're really looking at that level in that chapter is getting a very broad picture of things that might be influencing the home continent when you're back there. So it's like, are there pirates? Are there big empires? What is going on in this other continent that might create an effect on the home continent? So that you've got that little bag of ideas already in your head when you do start doing the much more detailed home continent. That was the thinking process in terms of how to organize it there, because really that other continents chapter is kind of a weird chapter. It's fairly short tables, and it's a broad set of options. And for almost everything, it says, if you want to do more detail on this, here's where you go. So it's kind of like, why is this chapter here? But that's the reason that it's there, is to create the external forces that may be working on the home continent. And it's a really fun chapter, I think, because you really can spit out a lot of cool ideas quickly. So that, I think that the level of coolness in the chapter sort of rescued the fact that this is a slightly odd thing. But, sometimes the way that you actually do something doesn't fit into a really nice pattern. And that was kind of the thing, is this is what I do. So I'm going to go ahead and cover how that's done, even though it doesn't make for a great flow in the book. So that's why it's.
I thought I thought it was a really interesting chapter. Go ahead, Paul.
I just wanted to jump in because I find that fascinating, the juxtaposition of the top down versus bottom up. Because what you're talking about, like the way it happens more organically, reminds me very much. I have notebooks from my campaigns I ran in high school, and this is years and years, decades ago, and. I'm reminded that I have a map of the area where my adventures were taking place. And then I would literally take that map to the library and put it on the Xerox machine and hit the reduce button to get it down to like 50% size, and then draw around the borders and then reduce it again and draw around the borders and slowly expand out and out. So I love that idea of like starting small, but then I need to know vagaries about these other outside the borders of the map areas.
And we did a question though, so to handle that. You know, here's a chapter that just generates vagaries.
Yeah, I love that. Out of curiosity, like, is there a concept in here of like a world character sheet, if you will, or like what would you expect the output of someone using the book to be?
Well, we're gonna do a PDF. We know some things, and we're going to have to refine how it works, but we're definitely going to do a PDF that's printable, because the books really are not very printable, because they've got those, they're going to have the black bar down the side with all of the Apophenia engine stuff, which we'll probably talk about. But so we'll do a much more printer friendly PDF. And the idea is that, yes, there will be a sheet for a culture. Because one of the things that you do, the geographical portion of the book advances culture by culture. You generate a cultural basin for the culture, based on the idea that a culture will usually expand until it reaches some sort of natural border, which might be another culture. It might be, a large forest. It might just be distance in the case of deserts or badlands or swamps or something like that. And so you do that culture all at once in one bite. You generate a template for it. Then you generate for each of the different countries that are in the culture, which is also defined, for each of those countries, it'll have a character sheet that it's got at least one variation from the cultural template to explain why is it a country as opposed to just being one large country. And that variation might be religious, it might be political, so on and so forth, might be linguistic. And so there are various options for that. And one of the parts that we're trying to work on is, how is that most easily trackable before we actually design those sheets? And I do have, in my word processor, a draft of that, but I'm not really 100%, now it's like the usability testing is still going on to find out what kind of things are you going to want to put in there.
Nice. And to be clear, I think you're talking about a stretch goal that you've already unlocked in the Kickstarter. So I believe Matt, you're committed to actually finishing that now at this point.
Yeah. It was a stretch goal at 90,000, which we blew past on like day two. And I'm not a big fan of stretch goals. When they make sense, I like to do them. I don't really like to use them as sales gimmicks. We're committed to doing that. That's already a done deal. It'll also have like, there's a hex map which is really, it's no different from any hex map that you could print out. But the thing is that the number of hexes, if they are 30 mile hexes, you will have 7 of those maps from the equator to the pole. And we've got a little, it's almost a throwaway paragraph in there, but it's like, so here's how that'll be divided. This will be Arctic and subarctic and boreal, I think, is all in the first of the 7. And then it'll tell you which map. And that way you can also sort of keep track of the biomes that are going to be in there. Because I don't know about you, but I do that since I start small. I completely forget there's a distance to the pole, there's a distance to the tropics, and I end up with rainforests that are really still way, way, way too close. So for those who care about that, it's not a big deal for me, but for those who care, having that hex map, is something that you can use to track where you are temperature-wise on an Earth-sized world. It'll have that. There's also the way that you generate a continent is with some little cutouts of an eight and a half by 11. So we've got a thing in there that will expand if you were to do Paul's trick of going to the library and increasing the size or decreasing the size. Basically, that's exactly what we did for the continent generator, so that you can cut out these little things and then build a shape of a continent that looks good, because most people have difficulty drawing from nothing a continental shape for things. And so this lets you move things around so that you can this doesn't quite look right, but then you can just move the sheet of paper. And then if we've got like the certain number where if you do that, if you print that whole page, your continent size more or less is going to be about the size of Europe. Europe fits nicely onto one page at that reduced size as it happens. There's a couple of little built-in hardwired tricks for doing that kind of thing.
Nice. Nice. Now, I noticed that you at least in the book, you give options of the referee could make a map with no spaces, or could use square spaces, or could use hex spaces. But it sounds like your personal preference is definitely hexes, it sounds like.
Not really. I mean, my personal preference is squares as a DM, because it's easier to do the A, and then the one on the two axes, so that you can reference the size. But first off, we needed to pick something, because for creating kingdoms, we needed some measure of size where you could roll dice and then say, okay, it's this many hexes or squares. And that really does not work with square miles or dimensions. You need to have either a hex or a square, basically. And my feeling was that the hex would generate sort of better natural coastlines and shapes for forest, because of the naturally ragged shape of a hexagon when people were following it. So just when you're counting out the thing. But the whole idea is that the map that you're building with, when you're following the tables and so on in the World Builder, that's really just a draft map that you're then probably going to want to trace over, and make it not match the hexes and the squares particularly well in the first place. But, everybody does distance differently, and it depends an awful lot on how you're going to use the world in the first place. I mean, if you're hex crawling, you want 5-mile hexes or 6-mile hexes, something that's way smaller than 30. But if you try to generate kingdoms using a hex that size, the count of the hexes is just enormous. If you're, even following, historically, it's just way, way, way too large for the mapping. So 30 worked pretty well. 30 is also a common reference point, especially for old school gamers, because that was what was done in the Greyhawk map. And so people have an intuitive sense of roughly how large a 30-mile hex is. And so that was really the difference between squares and hexes. And it's not like that. It's not like this is necessarily going to be your final gaming map, but we needed to have something that allowed space to be blocked off on the map in a way that you could count it out, and that works for doing that.
I could tell that there was some DNA from Darlene's famous Greyhawk map that kind of got through there, because the uh-huh. scales, the size, and your comment about the axis matches what they did there in Greyhawk. Total minor side point, there are the old Greyhawk map was a little bit awkward, because it was identified, again, a hex map with like what column you're in, and then what diagonal row you're in. Right. And I also think of, there's a lot of, I think, space games that have hex maps, but the axes are actually perpendicular, which I think is a little bit easier than that Greyhawk map. And so the horizontal axis is going to go, like this, but it's ultimately perpendicular, which I think is actually easier to use. So yeah. That was one kind of unique thing about the old Greyhawk map that we all dealt with at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the most usable hex maps are the ones where the hexes are numbered, like the old Judges Guild party, but that absolutely screws up the artistic view of the thing, because you've got all these numbers all over the place. But that's a very usable hex map.
True. Yeah, definitely true. But I suppose we shouldn't get too focused, because the vast majority of the Tome of World Building is not about mapping. It's about right. what's the contents in these areas and places and things like that. And I thought that the among other things, I thought you mentioned the cultural basin step, I thought was something that was novel to me. I was like, oh, that's a great way to kind of flesh out in part of a subcontinent, like the general culture that's going to be shared by a number of possible nations, I thought was an interesting step. At what point did that cultural basin idea occur to you?
It may have been when I was just thinking, way back about how do you, what size chunks do you generate terrain in? Because there are a bunch of different ways of generating terrain, but this sort of made everything hang together as a whole. Here we're going to generate the country, and then the other thing that we haven't mentioned is that when you do that, you're also generating the external borders. And so You've got, you know, what is probably largely clear terrain in the country, but you're also generating, and then there is a forest, you know, sort of in, you know, that's what stops the march of this culture is this large forest, or it might be an ancient wall that was left by, you know, an old civilization. And so the wilderness is sort of generated through, is generated as borders, and it's also generated as the blank spaces in between a culture, because you generate the size of the kingdom. So you get, you know, kingdom here, kingdom here, kingdom here, kingdom here. And now you're like, I'm done. And you're like, wait a second, what's this blank area in the middle here? And that's also, you know, you would go to the wilderness type of thing to fill in that gap as well. So that's how wilderness plays off against civilization. But the thing is that, you know, there's no algorithm for generating a map. So it's the hope is that, you know, people will just take it as being, you know, when you need the inspiration, okay, it's, you know, it's a country that's, you know, a river, and then the river runs along, and then there's another country down the river that doesn't have access to the sea because it's got to deal with this other country that's here. And it's you know, you definitely have to take it and run with it after a certain point, because it's not going to computer-like fill in all of the details.
Now, one of the things that I really like, that I personally appreciate in the book, and I feel quite a bit of kinship for, is that you have every chapter starts with, and the body of it's going to be a lot of ideas and kernels of concepts and tables and stuff like that. But every chapter starts with like a really nice several pages of real world research that you've done on geography or biomes or literature or population density or food production, with references about where you get these tent poles with, that really motivate and justify why you're sizing things the way you are and why you've got tables that emphasize particular concepts like that. And it's the kind of thing that I myself try to do to inform like my readers about where I'm coming from, and also not have to reduplicate that work. Because I think that a lot of old school gaming products have, I think, you know, Gary and Dave just had this environment where they assumed you knew about medieval weapons and you knew about food production, you knew about how fast an army travels and things like that. And I personally think it's really nice to have those references laid out, that we don't all have to go and again repeat that research to confirm that the move rates and the sizes and the city populations are fundamentally reasonable. So I really like seeing that in this book myself.
Yeah, but to be clear about it, a lot of that is up there because I'm doing something somewhat different in the tables. Because, like I said, I think that the most important thing about the book, and so really, it's more to allay the concerns of people who might not know what the reality of the numbers are. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, medieval population density at any time except for the Dark Ages was way higher than most people assume, having read Tolkien, especially Tolkien, that, you know, there was no wilderness anywhere in the medieval period. I mean, it was all, you know, it might be land that couldn't support, agriculture or something like that. But in that case, it was being used for herding and pasturing and so on. But part of the message that I really want to get across is that, look, a world, when you're designing a world for fantasy gaming, the most important thing is that it is directed toward creating the setting for a fantasy game. And anything that interferes with that is something you want to put aside. And so that, you know, but I do understand, because I've done it. I've got, you know, you're saying you don't have old campaigns. I've actually got one that I can see in my closet over there that's in a binder where I really did that. I went through and looked at books and what's, you know, how much does one acre, support in terms of grain for people, and just knowing that, But I think that, you know, most fantasy worlds work a lot better if you've got a much lower rural population density to support the adventuring in the wildlands, and a much higher urban population density because people want to go in and have, you know, big cities and so on and so forth. And so I think the real message is it's okay to do it that way. In fact, that's the best way to do it, is to follow the adventure production rather than the reality.
Yeah, the bit that really popped out at me in the Tome world building, the point where you said specifically Tolkien's world has impossibly low population densities, but it works. And I'll say for me, not being the biggest Tolkien scholar in the world, the first place where this popped out to me was actually the world of Greyhawk. So looking at Gary Gygax's world of Greyhawk, which is probably a little bit easier because he very specifically specifies what the populations of each country were. And at some point, I don't know how many years ago, I was like, that is wildly, wildly off the word Dark Ages reality by at least by one or two orders of magnitude. And then it occurred to me, like, probably most fantasy literature, and we can talk Moorcock or Lieber, they don't explicitly say, but it feels really largely empty. In that way. So it seems consistent a lot among a lot of fantasy worlds.
Well, because that's the nature of fantasy, is the crossing over from normal into the weird. And what that means is you have to have weird. And so if you're going to put it on a map, then that means you've got these large weird areas. Well, right there, you know, you've departed from the way that reality actually works, but for what you're doing, that's exactly what you want to do.
Yeah. Let me push a little bit with a possibly alternate strategy. We had our friend Peter Bebergall on, I think, a season ago, and he has an anthology called Appendix N, The Roots of Dungeons & Dragons. And I believe just in the last month or two, he has a second edition, like an enlarged second edition of it. One of the really nice package of short stories from writers that inspired Gygax in his first edition Appendix N bibliography. And maybe even some people that should have been included but weren't. And when I read Bebergall's Appendix N, I think the thing that occurs to me is that over and over again, you get this point of fantasy ne'er-do-well adventurers, and they come into a city. And the city doesn't seem to have, and it's in some kind of barren areas, it doesn't seem to have farmlands, it doesn't seem to have villages, trading isn't really a major point. They come into this like isolated city that has one very weird cultural problem. So one very, very oddball cultural novelty that they're going to have to deal with. And I'm wondering if it ever occurred to you that maybe the fantasy world doesn't even have countries. And I guess maybe at some point in Wizards of the Coast timeline, I think they were emphasizing the points of light theory. Of maybe the world is just a bunch of weird cities. Did you ever brush up on the idea of maybe I don't even have countries, or was that always something you felt you needed to have?
Here's the approach I took with that was more for the referee. One of the things that you can vary using this is is what I call the time feel. I may need to think of something catchier than that, but the time feel of the thing. And that was that some of the tables for when you roll that cultural basement and then you go to the contents of the cultural basement, you have to decide, do I care? And if I don't, then I'm just going to do any era. But there are sub eras for that. There's one that's for an ancient feel, one that's for an early Middle Ages feel, one that's for a later Middle Ages feel, and one that's for a heavy metal feel. Because those are all somewhat different in terms of what you would find. So in an ancient feel campaign, you're mostly going to have city-states or empires or tribal areas. And if you think about it, then that, you know, what you don't see in a campaign that's geared toward an ancient feel is a king, a parliament, Gothic architecture. You know, it's just not there, and actually the social organizations of people change in those different eras. And then in early Middle Ages, you've got, you know, a world that has just suffered some sort of cataclysm. In that case, it was twofold. It was the fall of the Roman Empire in 476. And then, well, actually, it was threefold. There was the fall of the Roman Empire in 476. There was the plague of Justinian in the 500s. And there was also a volcanic activity somewhere very close around that period as well that darkened the skies, dropped the temperature significantly, and caused problems for crops. So you had some, and I don't think it was really at a famine level most places, but in that society, getting close to famine meant that some areas were going to have famines. And so, you know, the early Middle Ages is, and is a fascinating period too, because, I mean, that's when you have Islam moving into Spain almost through an accident. It happened with a raid, and then just like in England, the king of Spain got hit in the eye with an arrow during the battle. The army evaporated. The raiders suddenly realized that the Spanish army wasn't reforming anywhere, and so they sent back, you know, ships, you know, real quick, you know, back to Africa, saying, you know what, they're gone. They're it's here for the taking. And so this little raid suddenly turned into a major invasion that captured almost all of the Iberian Peninsula, and then eventually, with the wars, it almost got to France. And so there are just fascinating things happening in the early Middle Ages that a lot of people just sort of write it off as this is the Dark Ages. You know, things get interesting again, you know, after the year 1000. But there's a definite feel to that. And so, you know, and then the social organizations of people, you know, are different there. You've got, you know, smaller kingdoms, some of them get subdivided, when you're rolling the thing on the map. And then you've got, you know, the later Middle Ages, where you've got much higher population densities, kingdoms are becoming much more centralized. And so you've got fewer areas, that you might be dividing into dukedoms or fewer disorganized areas, fewer, you know, less tribal land once you're into the later Middle Ages. And then when you're in the Dark Ages, you're a whole lot back. I mean, sorry. And then when you go to the heavy metal tables, then you're a lot back to the ancient feel again. There are some differences between those two tables, but the heavy metal one is a lot like, is, you know, big empires, you know, isolated city states that have one cultural vagary, just like you were talking about in the literature of the era, that, you know, so you can, there are sort of these toggle buttons where you can set the dial, to, I'm going to go for an ancient feel. I'm going to go for an early Middle Ages feel. I'm going to go for a late Middle Ages feel. And depending on how you set that dial, the cultural organization and the social organization is going to be a little bit different, depending on, you know, if you're using one table as opposed to the other, especially if you're consistent through the whole thing.
Nice. Okay, we just got a really great question in the chat here from Christopher Hawkins. And I'm personally struggling to get my arms around the Tome of World Building, because I think the draft that I saw clocks in at 115,000 words is what I saw, which is quite a bit. And we haven't even mentioned the second book on the naming yet. Christopher's question that I have on screen right now, a question for Matt: what is the smallest concept in the Tome of World Building? For example, do you go into the age of a village or other concept? And so far we've been talking about like the cosmos and the world and the continents in this top-down design. So how detailed does it get when you get to the back of the book, Matt?
First of all, hey, Chris, how's it going? we run into Chris at conventions all the time. He's a great guy. That is a really, really good question. And so you have to, it goes down to about the size of a city, but also that can be sort of a walled town kind of thing. And then the thing is that the Tome of Adventure design, since that's based on the whole idea that you may want to do a keep on the borderlands kind of thing, there's actually a lot about small settlements already in Tome of Adventure design. There were a couple tables that I ported over from Tome of Adventure design and repeated them in this book because I felt like it would be incomplete if I didn't, you know, have that table. So I would say that for the size of a village, that's somewhere where you would refer back to the Tome of Adventure design. Something that is a large-ish community will be covered in this. So for example, in the Nomicon, one of the tables is for street names. There's a lot of stuff about, you know, what's the individualized culture of a city, which actually that, I think that may be some of the tables that I ported over and duplicated are things on the cities, because there was a city adventure. There's a city adventuring section in Tome of Adventure Design, but you're also going to be wanting to do cities. And so I didn't drill down quite to the level of detail that we did in Tome of Adventure Design. We focused a little bit more on what is the city's role in politics or economic influence. Who might be the leader of the city? There's a whole bunch of stuff about leaders in these books, monstrous leaders, powerful spellcaster personalities, because that's one of the things, what really drives a campaign, really drives a world from DM and players is the big personalities that you run into in the world, or the way that the players are able to visualize things, which is often very, very encapsulated and caricatured in what actually sticks in the mind of the player is usually fairly different from what the DM, who has spent a lot of time crafting the world, is actually going to be saying. And there is a definite gap there. When they're there for a game, they are not going to listen to, a lot of talk, and they're not going to pay attention to a lot of talk about the world setting. Really tried to take that into account in the book, that this is a book about creating a setting for a fantasy game. Let's be real about what it is that the players care about, because it's not a lot of the stuff in this book they're not going to care about, except for the way in which it affects their characters. And so that's, or the way that it creates an adventure, which creating an adventure is sort of more what I was focusing on, was that, these little bits and pieces of stories, they fit into the world. But the idea is that the players are going to run into these and say, ooh, let's go do that thing. And so that's sort of the way that I was trying to create it.
Just to give our viewers a little taste of like what the body of the book does, and we don't have space on screen to show the enormous tables that you get in the Tome world building. So in that very interesting chapter 4 on other continents, your basic gesture is, let's come up with one odd detail, maybe two if you want to get fancy, about the other continents that are going to have some kind of effect on where the players are actually gaming. And so you have this master table of just like, here's one detail about a continent. And well, the table starts off
with what I was talking about. How many details are the players going to remember about the continent? One, it's going to be the continent of the bug people, in their heads. So build toward that outcome by just continent of the bug people. I'll fill it in later if I need to, but I've got the thing that they're going to remember, and that, they're not likely to even ever go there. Most people stay, unless it's a really travel heavy campaign, most people stay in, a fairly restricted area of the world.
Right. That makes sense. So I'm going to read just like the top couple of entries from that table, just so viewers can get a taste. So the entries of one detail about the continent go, one, a death religion with enormous catacombs, two, a giant swamp, three, legendary city of high technology, four, legendary city ruled by a god or demigod, a place that sends religious crusaders to your continent, invading in cycles. And so you have this table with, I believe, about 50 entries like that, and then every single entry sends you to another subtable with maybe like a six or a dozen additional sub details about what kind of city of the gods are we talking about versus what kind of death religion with enormous catacombs are you dealing with?
Except for minotaurs. I couldn't think of minotaurs. So minotaurs are just like, yeah, there's minotaurs. Anybody wants to, come up with an interesting subtable on minotaurs? Because I couldn't.
I was gonna be too polite to mention that, Matt.
Minotaurs apparently do not spark my creativity, but I was like, yeah, that's cool, a continent of minotaurs. And then after that,
viewers, can we do that right now? Let's do that right now. Okay, so Maze City, giant feedlot, bullfighting, right? A city with mutual bullfighting competition.
I don't think Minotaurs are going to be into bullfighting.
Well, if it's another Minotaur, it's mano y mano. It's gladiatorial bullfighting is what we've got going on here.
My brain immediately went to, of course, the teleporting Minotaurs from Rappanathic, right?
Yeah.
And it got to be
right. Right. Nope. Easy to do because they can teleport.
There you go.
There you go. There's a sub table.
I teleport.
Okay. Now I'm being told that was a little bit derivative because, quote, that's just UFC. Thanks, Techno Scald. I've been techno scalded.
Oh goodness! I think we can forgive Matt for missing 1 out of 50. I think
Well, it had to have Minotaurs, but every once in a while, I was just like, you know what? I can't think of a sub table. But almost everything else has, you know, some of them multiple sub tables, you know, because that's one of the areas where you can get your bug emperor or a construct, a thinking construct that rules an empire, and so there are plenty of, you know, more details that show up in there, just not for Minotaurs.
I bet it'll be there when it finally comes out.
Maybe this show may cause me to be like, God damn it! Okay, fine, I'm gonna.
Sorry. Now, one thing, as we've been talking, we're looking at all the great, some little samples of some of the great art, and you have a bunch of like at least half a dozen or so really excellent artists adding art to the book. No, I believe Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, no AI generated art here. I think you have actual human people providing their particular perspectives.
Yeah, no, it's all human. In fact, we've met, I think everybody, I think we have met all the artists in person, actually. We've got Chris Arneson is doing work for Adele Tigler, who did the Hyperborea books. Most people, that's probably the largest thing that he's done that people would be most familiar with him. Although he's also done a lot of our stuff. John Sumrow, I'm not sure whether it's Sumrow or Sumrow, but you know, he's doing that. Brett Barkley, who is an artist with does a lot of stuff with Dark Horse Comics. We've got who am I forgetting? Ken James, J.E. Shields. So yeah, there's a lot of artists who I tend to prefer the inked line art sort of approach. We do have some of these that are grayscale. Chris Arneson is particularly good at grayscale. So we do have, you know, some grayscale in there, but for the most part, you know, like the picture that I think is below me right at the moment, at least it may be below me. I don't know whether we've got our little squares organized properly. And
below you is correct. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, most of it is that sort of black and white line art type of thing, which I really just prefer in a creative book. I think, you know, I see the benefits of color art. It puts you right into the thing. I could see doing something like that for a rule book. But to me, black and white art just removes people one step from, you know, it moves you toward the fantasy, but it also keeps you realizing, you know what, I'm working with the fantasy as a tool. So I tend to prefer the black and white.
I would say about the same. It feels a little Hitchcockian to me of like, it suggests something and then there's still room for your imagination to fill in the rest, which is kind of a really nice middle ground.
The feeling of what's behind this picture or what's at the edge of the picture that at least I don't quite as much get with a colored thing. I mean, it's an odd reaction, but I really do prefer the black and white.
I looking at the sample you sent us, which has a little interior art credit section, so I could help jump in there in case you did miss anyone. And the only name I see on here that you missed is Matt Finch. So you did some of your own artwork?
I've done some pieces, and Susie loves to put those in the books. And it really, you know, it's next to guys who are just, you know, epic artists. And then here's my little thing that I did with, you know, when I was experimenting with, you know, how do you use a crow quill? I mean, my stuff's not bad. I mean, I'm relatively you know, talented amateur, but amateur is the key word there. There's an enormous difference between somebody who's a good amateur and somebody who is a real professional artist. So
I feel like there's a good tradition in old school game design of having to having to stick your neck out and show what your own art looks like, just like Dave Arneson would do. So I think that might be almost required at this point, Matt.
Well, fair. You know, all of the stuff that we're doing that's my art is from a long time ago. So I may have to get out some Bristol board and some Croak Wills and do some more stuff.
Great. Great, great. And to be clear, you briefly mentioned your partner, Susie Mosby, who does editing and layout work for products like Tome of World Building. So I believe a key component of Mythmere Games.
Absolutely, yeah. No, she designs the covers. You know, anything that's got an overall appearance to it is something that Susie has created. So and people don't tend to think about that aspect of things because we tend to focus on content, you know, but like even that Kickstarter page is a whole series of graphics that Susie has put together and made. So yeah, she's a major, you know, driving force. Plus the strategy of, you know, what are we going to, you know, we know what we're going to be doing next. You know, in this case, it's Osric. What are we going to be doing after that? There are decisions that you've got to make. So, you know, that's all, you know, she's very integral, but she hates being on camera, which is why you guys are not going to be seeing her in the show.
I would be happy to invite Susie by with you or by herself would be a great get. So maybe hopefully we can get Susie on at some point. Maybe
if you
can convince her that you have a good time here.
No, she just doesn't like being on camera. So.
They've got to respect that. Not everybody does.
Yeah, when she worked at Dwarven Forge and they were doing that documentary about Dwarven Forge, she, you know, she would hide every time the cameras show up. So she's not in that whole, they did a whole documentary where she was one of the key employees of the company and she's not in the documentary at all, except for like, you know, a little, you know, here's a person who is that shadow disappearing off in the corner. That was what.
But I mean, which is probably easy to do because there's some big personalities over at Dwarven Forge between Stefan originally and the other folks that really enjoy being on camera. It's probably pretty easy to thrust somebody else to take the limelight, probably.
Stefan is a big personality.
Right. Right. Now I gotta say, okay, so before we run out of time, I gotta say, I mean, there's a second book and viewers, in addition to this Kickstarter, there's a whole separate book we more or less haven't mentioned, and that's the Nomicon of coming up with names. And yeah. So just to kind of briefly scope that out, you have a whole bunch of different sections. You have 20 different language groups, many of which are based on real world languages, and then you also have tied in, there's a bunch of fantasy languages, including like Tolkien-style dwarves and elves and Lovecraftian dreamlands languages. And then each of those sections has got tables for naming people and terrain and cities and countries and continents and empires and gods and taverns, individual taverns and streets. And they all have a bunch of tables and subtables and ideas and motivations for it. Epithets.
Not every of one of the language groups has all of those things. The language groups tend to have, you know, depending on how divisible it was and how different the sort of sound was, you know, most of them, what they all have is something that will generate terrain features, which, and in a lot of those work just as well for cities. So there wasn't a reason to do a different table, but they all have something that allows you to generate terrain. All but a few of them have a way of generating personal names, and the ones that don't are the weird sword and sorcery type things, like, you know, metallic, or just if you think about you know, the Dying Lands being Jack Vance's sword and sorcery books, there, you know, the Dreamlandish and the Trobadoric languages work for the place names in that sort of a culture. But what then Jack Vance did was he pulled a lot of names from largely from Italian. And so in that one, I just say, look, go over to the Italic thing to get this, or maybe it's the Trobadoric thing, but the personal names, there's not really a Dreamland language personal names thing, just because it's not there. That's not how they did it. So, except for powerful spellcasters. So there's this and that in each of the different naming groups. And then there's a separate thing in general for taverns, you know, city street names, naming cities. There are some things that pop outside of the thing, like, you know, Glenn Cook's Black Company series. If you look at how he named cities in there, most of them had names like Roses, Opal, and that really doesn't fit in any of the naming groups. So there was a separate section on that. You know, sometimes the organization gets a little bit messy when you're trying to cover it, but. So yeah, there's a lot of different things. Naming strongholds has got a separate section, because if you're going through and you're naming strongholds, it's more useful to get something that sounds like a stronghold than it is to get something that's within the cultural group. And so I did a separate section on strongholds.
I think that makes sense. I think that makes a lot of sense. And then you have, and I'll just mention, like, probably the thing that stood out as possibly my favorite is you have a section, again, in that kind of appendix part at the end, of monarchs and nobility and titles and epithets. And then you have one particular table that is titled the Yes, Your Wickedness table, of for a particular supervillain, malign, horrible despot, of the actual negative epithet that the that the noble embraces and must be addressed as. That you point out that your players will probably not take this as seriously as the other stuff, but you got to have. I enjoyed the Yes, Your Wickedness table.
Once I thought of that, it had to go in the book, because you can't. And I was like, this is going to be totally unusable, because, you know, if I have to address somebody, yes, your monstrous infidelity or something like that. You're Monty Python. You know, the Monty Python quotient is going to go through the roof the second that they hear that as the title of the monarch. But it had to go in there. So, you know, there it is. It's in there. Do with it, you know, what you will. But understand that the players are going to giggle their heads off when you use it.
I think I really like that you span a whole lot of tonal possibilities, and the DM can pick and choose of how far they want to push that, and the fact that you can go as far as Monty Python-esque, insane, completely insane. But I feel like that would fit in a lot of weird fiction that we've read. I feel like that would fit in possibly Vance or something like that. That seems very familiar
to
me.
Absolutely, it would fit in Vance. Absolutely, it would fit in Vance.
Right? Yeah, that's a great catch. How long have you been working on the world of tome building? So, because you mentioned pre-show that, like, Tome of Adventure design, you started with these ideas in the 90s. Have the world building ideas been dancing around as long, or how long?
A few of them have, like I said, that old campaign that I did has got a list of names. It was one that was very Celtic. And so, you know, I had a list of names in there, you know, used some of these techniques, you know, in that. So some of the core ideas about how to write something like this go back that far. But actually assembling tables for it, has only been like about a year, maybe, you know, with some of them coming from here and there, because I do keep tables. This one, I had a lot of the ideas about how to do it, but didn't start working on it. People have been asking me to do this book almost since the day that Tome of Adventure Design came out. Was people were like, when are you going to do one for Building a World? And I think it was probably the point at which it became a real and workable product was probably when I came up with that idea of the cultural basin that you were talking about. And that sort of made all of the pieces click. Here's the method that you can follow going through it. And so that's probably somewhere around there was when it became a real thing, which was about a year ago. And then from there, it's just been writing.
Nice. It felt like that was a really important concept.
It was.
Like that was a new thing to me.
Well, it's not brand new, because as I discovered, Kevin Crawford. Also, when I went back to look at his book to make sure that I hadn't forgotten any major sort of tables, and this is, Worlds Without Number, I think is his fantasy one, which, you know, recommended to folks. He did something very similar to what, the same thing I did. He was started, you know, here are, you know, initial facts that you want to determine ahead of time. And his is game rules. So it's a somewhat different slant to the whole thing. But, you know, you generate a few things ahead of time. And then he generated regions rather than thinking of it as a simple culture. But it's the same sort of thing of if you want to generate something good, generate several things simultaneously together with the relationships between them and what the borders look like on the outside. And so as it turned out, he followed a very, very similar way of strategy. Organizing the bite. It's sort of the size of the bite is really how it goes. And it's that, you know what, you actually do have to take a pretty big bite if you want to be generating stuff by tables for a world. It's much larger than just an isolated country at a time. You work at a larger level. You know, his wasn't the cultural basin, and like I said, the cultural basin was sort of the generative idea that organized it. But so I mean I don't think it's new. There's not a whole lot that's new in terms of this. I mean, people have been doing this stuff, you know, for many, many years. But yeah, the cultural basin, I think that was what really made everything suddenly fit together in terms of, yeah, okay, here's how a book would look.
Nice.
Gentlemen, we are just about out of time here. Matt, I want to give you just a last call out here. Is there anything we missed? Anything about the Kickstarter or the books that you want to make sure you mention to our audience?
I don't think so. I mean, hopefully people will back the Kickstarter. You know, it's doing very well. The books are going to be very high quality, like we always do. We're going to send them to, you know, they'll be, you know, in signatures, you know, stitched and, you know, very, very high quality binding. Uncoated paper, if we can get it. That was difficult back in the pandemic. That's why some of our early books have, you know, a glossy finish to them. But no, I think that's it.
Awesome. Awesome. Viewers, if you want to check out the Kickstarter, please do. The link has been placed in the chat. It's also available here in the description of the YouTube video. At the time of recording, I think there's about 45 hours left, so hopefully you're watching this episode very, very recently. But hop on in there. And if not, I know that that by practice that Kickstarter will, once a Kickstarter has been successful, the page remains active. So I'm sure you can use that link to find out how you can get yourself a copy of the of the Tome of World Building.
And yeah, definitely. And of course, remember, go ahead. Yep. Yes. All of it. All of it. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub by the handle Wandering DMs. So look for us there. And please hammer on that like button. We always appreciate that.
If you prefer to listen to our shows in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also, the various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every single tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversations continue round the clock all the time about old school gaming and new school gaming and horror games and sci-fi and basically everything. And we just have the smartest patrons in the land, and they have great ideas for your campaigns if you have questions or things like that. Of course, just like Paul said at the top of the show, we will be there for the live after chat in about 10 minutes. And I think we've convinced Mr. Matt Finch to join us today. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So please look for Matt Finch's, it's a product that we love. Please look for Matt Finch's Tome of World Building Kickstarter on the links that Paul pointed out. We are really hoping, we're really close to getting over the 200,000 level actually there. So we're really hoping that Wandering DMs patrons can help boost that over the end line there in the last 2 days or so. Yeah, and so we'll be on the... Yes, please do. So we'll be on the live after chat in about 10 minutes, I think. And don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.